From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom to the dressing room to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
Listen.
Well, welcome everybody to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? I am very sheepishly at my computer, and I'll explain why shortly in South Carolina. While Rog is, I haven't had time to find out yet, but I presume you are in the lake.
Yeah, I'm back in Como after the trip to Vegas, and I'm on the lake.
Hey, listen, Rog, you made it back from Vegas. That's always the main worry.
I even made some money on the tables, mate.
Hey, steady on. What, betting on them or waiting on them?
I made some winnings and I gave them to the croupier. Give me some credit.
Okay.
She was a nice girl.
Yeah, I bet she looked very suspiciously at you once you'd heard your Scottish accent. You started giving away money. There's something not quite right about that. I'm surprised you weren't in handcuffs. Now, all right. There's a peek behind the scenes coming up because, as you are about to hear, our guest this week, Matt Rogan, who I'm going to let Roger talk to you all about him in a second, gave a fantastic interview. And like you, I am going to enjoy listening to the first half of it when this podcast goes to air because I had a few issues and managed to miss the beginning of the interview, which you will hear all about when we get about halfway through. So look for the appearance of an idiot at about 40 minutes into the conversation. But before we get to Matt, Rog, we have to do a quick goal on goal because boy oh boy have I seen some stuff this weekend.
Yeah, I can imagine. Fire away. You're the guy that was there in situ in one of the arguably greatest moments in sport, arguably being the word, but you know, you tell us all about it, mate. You and your dad.
Well, I've got to say this: we didn't go on Sunday purely because, yes, Sunday is actually the worst day to be at the Masters because you don't really know what's going on. You get a delayed. You can hear the roars, which is cool because you hear those on Friday and Saturday, and so you know that stuff is happening. And you can tell actually by the rules, you know when it's Tiger and you kind of know where he is on the course. So if you know the course, you can tell where the roars are coming from. So my dad and I were sitting on 15 for much of the afternoon on Saturday and we knew where Tiger was on the course. And you would hear a roar as like, you know, that's coming from the eighth green. That's Tiger birdieing or eagle in the eighth green. And then you knew when he was coming down behind us on sort of 13. We knew when he'd birdied 13. So it's a fantastic theatre, and there's a real sense of understanding what's going on. But it's not really the place you want to be on Sunday when you want to see all the stuff that was going on. I mean, it was remarkable. It was a fantastic thing to be a part of. I mean, we didn't know, obviously. We knew he was in the hunt, but I will say we were standing, my dad and I, under the tree on Saturday, and we were just kind of chatting to some friends of ours, and Tiger walked past us on his way from the clubhouse to the putting green. and he walked literally right next to us, and the focus in his eyes was something to see. I have to say, he really did have that. And I commented to my dad. I said, "You know what? He's serious about this. This isn't. I mean, people were going, go get him, Tiger. His eyes just didn't move. So you could tell that he was serious about it. And I have to say, you know, I've seen him play a few times, and I've watched him on TV a lot, obviously. And the thing that was different about this, that there were no errant shots, there was no wild drives. You know, there were a couple that missed the fairway, but you know, nothing, none of those snap hooks.
He was
superbly in control, and it was just a fantastic thing to be a part of. You know, it really, really was.
I think he did fantastic. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about it in the course of the interview and at the back end as well. I felt sorry for Molinari, of course. Because like he just played beautifully until the back nine.
He had two bad holes. He had two poor shots. That was it.
Well, you know what? I have to say, Grant, I looked at him at the start of the last round and he didn't look great. His putter was saving him.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the writing was on the wall. But you know, I love that guy. We'll talk about a little bit in the interview about people that make the maximum of their talent. You know, this is a guy that's always been a good ball striker, always been a good golfer. Was been rubbish at putting, and turned that around through hard work. So I really like Francesco Molinari, and you know, he's had a great year and. The Tiger story, the redemption is one that all true, authentic sports fans probably need to get behind.
Yeah, no, Molinari is impossible not to like. He's just a wonderful character, and you can see he's just a really down to earth, genuine guy. So, I actually thought he was going to win. I thought he was just too consistent for Tiger to make up those two shots. And I said at the start of the day to my dad, I said, if anyone wants to win this, they've got to shoot a minimum of three shots better than Molinari, and that's not going to be easy to do. But it just felt like it was meant to be, Roger. It just felt like it was one of those preordained results. But kudos to Tiger. He won the old Tiger way, right? He was just relentless, and the other guys, they didn't hand it to him. I mean, he won it. But it was interesting just to see the atmosphere around the place and see all these golfers who'd never played against him in his prime get a taste of what it was like when he was at the top of the leaderboard. It was fantastic. To do it with my dad was just a real thrill.
Fantastic. I've only got one little thing I just want to say before we get into the guest, which is wonderful. BBC website, I saw it, caught my eye, and I had to do a double take. Tottenham have banned several, in inverted commas, fans for persistent standing since their new stadium opened this month. Banned fans for persistent standing.
Wow.
I mean, goodness me. You know, honestly, in these podcasts, there really is a lack of sensitivity around certain things. You know, they're already worried about prices rising. So you're going to chastise them and punish them because they get off their bums, as sport is meant to do, to get you off your seat, and you're going to ban them from their club in their new stadium because they're over exuberant. Surely there's a better way to do that, Grant.
Well, it's ridiculous, Roger. I mean, it is
BBC
ridiculous.
Website.
I get it if there's someone sitting behind them that doesn't want to stand up or you know whatever. I mean, I understand what the problem is, but that's not the solution. I mean, it just isn't. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, what do you want? You just want everybody sitting quietly in a football ground and you know, everybody behave yourselves. I mean, it's an emotional experience to go there if you're a fan. And so how can you be expected? I mean, I presume what they mean by persistent standing is they're standing up for the whole game, you know, not just when the ball's in the corner.
Yeah, of course that's
what
they mean.
Whatever.
But, you know, we can deal with that differently.
Yeah,
you know,
there's a better way to handle it, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, that's a goal and an own goal. We've just split the duties between us this week, which is perfect.
Yeah, so let's get on to Matt because it's
really
worth
tell the audience a little bit about Matt Rogan.
Well, Matt is somebody that I must admit that I personally really, really admire because he's got a very similar background to me. He comes from the music business, had the same kind of like childhood with music and sport. He went into consultancy, which, as you know, is my core business. But then he had the balls to go and set up his own company with his family in the middle of, you know, very, very young children and all the mortgages and all the worries that, doing that entails. And he, with his company Two Circles, has, I would say, it's not an exaggeration to say, redefine the way that sport is marketed, the way that rights holders look at their customers, their fans, how they approach them, how they engage with them, and has taken sport, I would suggest, into the world of Spotify. So if this comes across as quite admiration show, this interview, I apologise for that up front, but I think Matt and Two Circles are one of the favourite things I've seen in the sports industry in the last 5 years.
Well, I was going to say, let's bring him in, but this one's on you for the first half. So away you go, Rog. Let's hear what you and Matt had to talk about.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
How are you doing? Yeah, fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me on and all that. It's nice to actually chat. I think we met each other really fleetingly once, but given the amount of digital exchanges we've had, it's ridiculous. We haven't actually got the chance to meet and have a beer.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. I've admired you from afar, as one says, and I want to thank you for coming on the show because
no worries.
Thank you, thank you. Listen, my partner in crime, Grant Williams, you know, the one of the good radio voice.
Oh yeah.
I think he's still suffering from Augusta hangover, because.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, it's 6 o'clock there where he is, and he's not surfaced yet. So we're going to kick on. Matt, and give him a pass because it was the most amazing Masters, wasn't it?
It was pretty good, wasn't it? It's not many sports that where you can engage everyone in our family on my laptop while Chelsea are playing at the same time. But the Masters went out this weekend.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. Listen, Matt, you know, I think the kind of like format of our podcast, it's not a fan podcast, and it's certainly not a business podcast. It's speaking to people that are at the top of the industry, invested in the industry, but that are true sports people. And I know very much how much that's true for you, but I'd like you to share it, if you could, with the listeners.
Yeah, no problem.
I mean, from what I know, you're a big tennis guy, big cricket guy, Chelsea fan, and a coaching father of some very active kids that are involved in all kinds of sports. So, Matt, tell me a little bit about where all that started.
Yeah, so my background actually was, I guess I fell in love with sport age 4 or 5, like a lot of impressionable boys growing up, or just on the outskirts of London. I was lucky myself to have two sporty parents. I used to spend Saturday afternoons going to watch my dad play for Denham United, which was the local men's side, about 400 yards away from me. And as my mum kind of got over having three sporty kids herself and got back to sports, she got back into tennis. And so when I wasn't watching my dad, I was watching my mum and hitting a ball against the wall in Ivor Heath, a little tennis club down the road from us. And so sport bit me early. Interestingly, despite really being able to engage with too much of it on the TV, but glued to my fairly analog radio, where sports broadcasts and football broadcasts on Radio 2 was my diet and way of engaging with live sport as a way of feeding my addiction.
And in that time, in those times, was it like a lot of us that it was football most of the year, then the summer cricket and tennis kicked in, or was tennis a bigger part for you all the way through?
So for me, so I guess this is context. So I'm one of three kids. I have two twin sisters, they're identical twins, actually, a couple of years younger than me. And so my mum and dad had one car, and as a result, I was the lucky one. So because I was slightly older, I effectively got the first pick of sports, and then my sisters kind of had to pick the same one in order that our family could balance it at all. I guess football was probably some of my earliest memories. Cricket actually hadn't crossed my door at all until my son started playing, sort of 5-6 years ago. So I'm very recently engaging with cricket. But tennis was the second one. And I guess I found myself really right up until the end of university, engaging with both, enjoying both for different reasons, certainly benefiting from playing an individual sport and a team sport, and the different challenges that gives you. If you looked objectively at my sporting career, I'd probably describe it as a sort of senior amateur level of both, perhaps not quite ever getting the extra 2-3% that I might have got via specialism, but learning a lot more about life, and I guess making a lot more friends from all sorts of different backgrounds as a result of having played both. I've represented university and stuff for both. So had a good innings. Funnily enough, had a real thrill at the moment. So I played, probably the best football I played was for a non-league side called Church of Town. Uh-huh. And our chairman at the time, who was also our manager and took us all the way up from being absolutely hopeless at under-11s through to winning most things and playing the FA Youth Cup and stuff at under-17, under-18. His big goal was, as chairman of Chertsey, was taken to Wembley. And this year, actually, a couple of weeks ago, they won the shootout against Northwich Victoria. So
I saw my post junior on that,
side
yeah.
finally make Wembley in the FA Vars final in a couple of weeks' time. So it's kind of come full circle.
That's fantastic. And tell me, Matt, what position did you play on the football field?
So, what position did I play, or what position did I want to play? I the best football I played, I probably played as a wing back in a 5-3-2, fairly two-footed. Used to idolise Graham Lassow going up and Dan Petrescu going up and down the two wings at Chelsea in that regard when they were sort of playing good football defeat under Hullett and Hoddle, and that was probably the best position I played. When I played maybe slightly a lower level later on, I sort of found myself in centre midfield, being the only one who managed to keep himself fit enough to play that. But really, I guess I was an attacking fullback. I was quite good at throw-ons as well, which is always quite important when you're not playing a great ground. You have to go chase the ball in order to chuck it back on.
Well, I think that helps everybody put a little bit of context there, because you also mentioned the time scale of your Chelsea side that you followed. You kind of like, you probably got into that when Chelsea was leaving its previous skin, as it were, and becoming what it is now, which is a global brand and a global club. As a fan, how did you live that moment?
Well, I guess the story started for me in 1982. I think it was the first game I went to see. Chelsea were hovering around the bottom of the then Division 2. We lost an abject game at home, 2-0 to North County, and Peter Benetti made a bit of a rickets. I remember that firmly as my first formative memory in the East End, almost bankrupted the club, but actually is still part of the stadium today. And a lot of my formative sort of football memories of Chelsea really were probably being too young to stand in the shed and being kind of moving around very quickly on the terraces and feeling a little bit out of control. And then going every week to watch with my dad on Saturday afternoon, sitting on what was the benches. That very nice description of basically a lump of concrete that was always wet and soaking on the west stand. And watching, as you say, you know, watching a fairly average side sort of going up and going down and going up and going down out of then Division 2 into Division 1. And then I guess as the Premier League into the light, starting to develop, and there's, as you say, a little bit more finance, initially Matthew Harding and then, of course, Roman Abramovich, just seeing the club's performance on the pitch and off it change and evolve and improve. And I guess this podcast, a lot of people have different views about what of that is for good and what of that is for bad. In any professional sports environment, not specific to Chelsea, I guess my experience of taking my son, similar kind of age as I was, listening to the language and watching the rucks and things around the Notts County game, taking my son to Chelsea now, I can be pretty comfortable. You won't be exposed to bad language. You certainly won't be stood up, wandering around slightly, can't see his feet in this massive crowd that's wandering around the shed. It's a far safer, more pleasant way to get your starting to fall in love with the same club that you did?
Well, you're right to say that we often talk about this, and you know, my own personal career, for right or for wrong, was about implementing with quite a bit of zeal the Taylor Report in Scotland, and actually mm-hmm. preventing teams from getting promoted when they didn't meet the criteria. So I empathise totally with that. At that time, I was with one of the people that you probably were watching in those days, Pat Nevin, who was our first guest on the podcast. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with that kind of player. You know, you are I can tell that you had good feet, because they wouldn't have put you in central midfield if you didn't have good feet. So tell me, you know, what in football, what were the kind of things that got you out of your seat, or even when you were on the field, you looked at a guy playing and you said, "Wow, I wish I could do that."
You know what? I think Nevin, without wanting to get too stats focused on in the wide world of Chelsea in the early 90s, early 80s rather. So Nevin, Dixon, Speedy, Cannaville were part of really the first attacking force I ever saw Chelsea had real potency, with no, I guess, unashamedly, just thought those four as an attacking force were phenomenal. And Pat Nevin in particular, he was one of the first footballers in a lot of ways for me that sort of transcended, because I didn't know George Best, I didn't know any other previous footballers who sort of transcended football. But from the early days, you know, Pat Nevin was a bit of a music fan as I was. He was really intelligent guy, a really intelligent thing to say off the pitch. I'm not necessarily sure many of the rest of the Chelsea team did it at that time. But he was that sort of seeing a team that you're attached to attack with dynamism was just phenomenal. Now, of course, when I say seeing, what I really mean was listening to. So 83, 84, I was 8 or 9. Dad was still playing on Saturday. I didn't get to go to many games, but I, a lovely guy who my dad worked with was a season ticket holder, and used to bring me home on a Monday night after Dad saw him at work on a Monday. He used to always bring me home a program. So seeing, I used to see pictures in the Chelsea program of the day of these players going about their stuff. And occasionally, I think that season we played Liverpool in an FA Cup game that was broadcast live on the BBC. And that for me was just mind blowing. I could actually watch these people play and watch these people perform. And Nevin for me was everything I really wanted to be. But if I'm really honest, and I guess it sort of permeates now the things I'm really proud of when I see my kids on a pitch. If I'm really honest, I probably felt less for Nevin's quick feet and movement, or Dixon's fairly languid goal scoring, and I did for David Speedy's just craft. Extremely really? Talented, but also just a wow. worker, you know, and got so much out of his career and so much of his talent, because he was prepared to go into the places other people weren't prepared to go, was prepared to really put the metal down to do whatever he could for his team. And that's, I guess, just hopefully permeated a lot of what I try to do from a work perspective too, and a parent perspective.
That's really
too,
interesting.
You know, work hard, play harder type approach.
Well, that's really interesting, because, you know, in some of the earlier podcasts, we did this 10 questions thing that we used to get into the head of the guests. So coming to tennis for a second, I'd like to come back to Chelsea in a minute. Coming to tennis, so who are you, Borg or McEnroe?
I'm probably more Borg. I'm definitely a slow court player. I'm a hopefully fairly smart on a court, but also more of a match player than I am beautiful to watch. I have so much respect for the way Andy Murray gets the most out of his talent, because he's a thinker on court.
Wow.
And so for me, the beauty of tennis is just the isolated nature of one-on-one combat. It's just a little bit safer than boxing. But it's that for me that the tennis gives. I'm more of a singles player than a doubles player. I'm more an Andy Murray than a Jamie, just because it's the total isolation that I love about the sport. I played a reasonable level growing up. I was booted out quite rightly of the era of South Regional squad that Henman and Jamie Delgado James Bailey and James Davison were playing in. They were in the kind of top squad. I was the next one down, and I just didn't have it physically. I wasn't quick enough. I wasn't light and tall enough. But I've thoroughly enjoyed a really rewarding sport ever since. And I do think as a kid, it teaches you other things. Because like it or not, when you're 10 years old and you double full match point up and then go off to lose the game in front of 15 adults, you know, it's pretty formative. And, you know, that it definitely teaches you accountability. It teaches you to handle those moments of pressure. It teaches you to, you know, to be honest with yourself in a way that purely playing team sport, I don't think ever really does. Well, unless you're a keeper, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think I said before with one of the other guests, I actually found team sports much, much better because different to you, I was an only child and you know, that gave me a kind of a feeling of belonging and that I didn't have anywhere else. And I always preferred team sports and, you know, but I do understand what you're saying regarding single sports, whether it was cricket in the middle or tennis or even golf. You learn an awful lot about yourself. For example, I was watching the Masters with my son and, you know, he's not that much into golf because he grew up in Italy and it's not a big sport. But we're watching Molinari and I say, look, it's the back nine, it's coming up to Amen Corner and everything changes. And he says, I don't get that. I said, you will. Everything changes. And then, you know, you see the two guys in front of Molinari put it in the water at 12 and Molinari the same. I said, I'm telling you, that's what single sports do. It makes you look deep into yourself, look deep into yourself and find out who you really are under moments of intense pressure. And I think, as you say, and I've heard you say this before, it really makes a very clear link to what you did in setting up a company. I think if you don't have that background, it's very difficult to say and have the guts to say, I'm going to set up a company.
Yeah, I think maybe that's true. At the same time, yeah, if I hadn't played a team sport and captained various teams over the years, I probably have struggled more with the notion of saying, well, sure, you know, it was myself and Gareth, who's your talented CEO, and my wife Claire, our CFO, who set the thing up. But it never felt like our business. I think all of us would say we never felt like it was the three of us alone playing our individual tennis matches. Very quickly, the business grew. And actually, what I'd learned coaching a ladies' football team or captaining a men's team actually very quickly became more pivotal to the, you know, the 9 to 5, 9 to 6, 9 to 7, whatever it was, day-to-day work leading a team to achieve what we've managed to achieve so far. It was the tennis experience and the ability to go deep within yourself and say, no, come on, we can get there. That was probably the thing that I went back to when it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was staring at the clock radio going, okay, we've got some challenges here. How are we going to get through them? How am I personally going to navigate through them? And I think it's that blend of experience that I lean heavily on daily. So both the individual personal resilience, personal focus, but from mindset stuff, balanced with the ability to lead, coach and develop teams. I think both have been really important to us. And it's for that reason that what I would wish most for my son, my daughter, or any child really is just to have an experience of playing a blend of individual and team sports. So I don't think either's better or worse for anyone in terms of a background and a formative experience for life. I think ideally just get a chance to get exposed to both.
Absolutely. I want to continue on that a little bit, Matt, because you talked about leadership there. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Richard Gillis on, who has written a book and has opined quite a lot about maybe the over glorification of a leader. And I said on that podcast, I mentioned the Brearley example in sport, but also my experience in the creative industries, especially in the music industry, that my experience was completely different. I've seen organizations turn around on a dime, really, on the charisma of a great leader. And I know you've got some strong views on it. You started talking a little bit there, but tell me what you've done with Two Circles, the ethos you brought in, and how that is always related to your direct experience as a sportsman.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I say is I think Rich's book's cracking.
it is.
I know, a lot of time for Rich, a lot of time for Rich's book. And I think in some ways, my interpretation of what the captain myth is saying is actually that the importance of captaincy in what's effectively a pop-up team every 2 years, where people have their own backgrounds, their own dynamics, their own ways of managing self and others. And they're using one isolated example every 2 years and post-rationalizing that who was a good leader and who wasn't on the basis of one result. And the challenge of that, I think Richard Wright challenged that. But I think it's a jump too far to say, based on that premise, leadership is therefore over-egged in its importance in any other walk of life. So actually, for my sins, I ran a leadership development business before setting up Two Circles.
Lane 4.
Wrote quite a lot about it. Yeah, Lane 4. Working into a phenomenal chief executive, the Olympic swimmer, I got the Adrian Morehouse.
Yeah.
Who himself won Sunday Times Leader of the Year twice. And what I think we noticed through all the data that we ran, all the various corporate and sporting and other elite performance like the Marines and the Navy examples that we looked at, is actually you can only see the impact of leadership over time. And it's very, very hard in a single event isolates the role that a leader played or didn't play, unless it's a fairly tactical thing, such as I'm going to pick this player or not pick this player for this particular set of four balls. Actually, what's more interesting and more powerful is when you look at the role of a leader in setting the culture, setting the context, and driving long-term sustainable change and resilience in an organization. I don't think Rich himself said, you know, he challenges his own argument. He looks at someone like Alex Ferguson changing the culture at Manchester United. No, validly, I think. So I'm not sure my view necessarily is opposed to Rich's. My view of leadership is heavily informed by Lane 4. And I think it's pretty simple, really. Whereas for any organization, we've certainly tried to model this, Gareth and I, in Lane 4, along with our kind of current management team, say, look, you have a strong, compelling vision to know exactly where your organization is trying to go. And not only for that to be held within a hierarchical 4, 5, 6, 10 management team, but for that to be co-created and ideally built together and challenged together by as many people in the organization as possible. So when you hold that vision and you hold that direction of travel really firmly as an organization, then the job of the leader really is just to support and challenge everybody within his or her organization to move the organization towards the vision. So I think what we notice in sport is a lot of organizations are fairly woolly as to what they're actually trying to achieve. I think if you look at a lot of agencies, certainly, you know, I try to help a few informally, you know, and the first thing I try and say is, what are you trying to do here? Like, what's the goal?
Absolutely.
So I met a startup agency this morning who just asked some advice, and I kind of said, so what's the goal? You know, are you trying to build something that's a cohesive part of a balanced life that you lead, or are you trying to build something quick to sell it? And they couldn't really answer the question. So we got no chance of leading an organization's success. You can't organize and leading your team's success if you can't align behind what you're trying to go start off with. The first part is vision. The second one is support and challenge. And we believe at Two Circles that the best organizations are both high challenge and high support. So if you get a leader who's all challenge and no support, you get burnout, you get frustrated employees, you get high churn, you get no quality. And I would argue that 25, 30 years of agency life and sports industry life has been in that world. Work them hard, burn them hard, don't give them learning, don't give them the opportunity to love steam, don't give them the opportunity to progress, but that's fine because there'll be another 15 people around the corner who'll take your job tomorrow.
Sexy business, it works for everybody, yeah.
Yeah. And the other extreme of that is high support, no challenge. You know, so it's fine. We're making money. No need to change everything. We know we've got the same people in the same roles for years. We know that's not going to change or need to change for the next 15. It will all be okay. Let's keep our heads in the sand and tell each other we're doing a really good job. And I would argue that 70s, 80s, and even 90s, most clubs and teams and leagues were in that place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And our two circles view of the world is to say, well, it's be really clear about what we're here to do. You know, our vision statement is change the game of sports marketing. It's not do it slightly differently, it's do it manifestly differently, and just try and bring a different level of quality and intellect and evidence and decision making into the industry. And the way in which we try and lead that change as a management team in the business is high support and high challenge of our team members. And sometimes, you know, we need to take the challenge down. It's a high support environment. Give people time to work out where they're going in the next piece of their lives. Work out how they can work on different projects which help them around as individuals. Work out how they can support our Gives Back program. And sometimes it's just time to knuckle down and do something you've not done before for a sport that's not done it before for the next 3 years. And it's high challenge time. But ultimately, if we can look back at the end of the year and have led people through high challenge and high support years, where they feel like they've grown as individuals, then beyond what perhaps two circles, hopefully we've created a cadre of people who are going to be a massive influence on this industry for the next 30 years.
I think that gives everybody a really clear idea of why Two Circles has been so successful. I think most people listening to this podcast will know your story, but I want to make sure, so I'm going to take a Bob Willis length run up to explain Two Circles and what your vision is. And I'm going to start in the music business, Matt, which you and I have in common.
We do.
And I think that really has informed how we see the world and how we see sport, because we saw something happening, which was the unbundling of the LP to specific choice around what you wrote about recently, the Spotify era. And I think all of us that were in that industry were dreadfully impacted by what we saw there, and we realised that the world was going to change. So correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is how I would describe Two Circles. You have been at the forefront of realising that there's a change in a model underway in the sports industry, from being predominantly, as you said in the past, relatively lazy, B2B, do a TV deal, do a highlights deal, title sponsorship, and send out your ticket, season ticket renewals to the same folk every year. It's gone from that to the world of the other extreme, Netflix recommendations, ARPU, deep data, making sure that you're getting the right content on the right screen to a segmentation of fans. Did you see all that coming 4 or 5 years ago to set up Two Circles, or did it kind of like come to you bit by bit?
I think we saw it coming, but I think we've been surprised by which bits of the sports industry have embraced the journey quicker than others. And I'll say a bit more about that. So you're absolutely right. What I was at, in the music industry, I just joined MTV. Was at the Music Awards in Frankfurt at the time that iTunes launched. And what you had there was an industry which, despite complete seismic change in the way people booked travel or accommodation or bought things online at the turn of the century, music and sport and arts and theatre and entertainment, everything just kind of existed in this 20th century vacuum and managed to sustain that. And iTunes came in, completely changed the model for music. And the lazy assumption is to say, well, wasn't it great in the world of the LP days, where we could to our price, we could buy an album for $5.49, we could listen to 12 tracks, we then have to wait on the radio for the charts to hear any new music, or borrow an album that our friends had. And it was a fairly static industry. And our only recourse otherwise to new music was MTV. And MTV, as a result, had this amazing market leadership position. And over the course of 3-4 years I was there, I just saw that broke down completely.
Yeah.
As a result of, the labels not needing MTV anymore in order to get to the end consumer.
Yeah.
Young adults and having other mechanisms, some legal, some Napster and illegal, in terms of learning about new music and consuming new music, having their taste change. I noticed a reaction to that with live music becoming a much bigger part of the economic model for sport again, when sure. things have been dying. And just the senior management in music just completely struggled to cope and take really 15 years to get their heads around
Absolutely.
The change. And so I saw a lot of the patterns. I sat down with Gareth at the time, was an interim role at Manchester City, and I was sharing some of my MTV experience. He was sharing some of the things he was noticing at Manchester City, and it became pretty apparent to us that sport was just beginning to see some of the, I guess, the kind of rumblings of an earthquake coming around the corner. What we noticed was that Gareth's experience at City really understanding the value of putting divergent data sets together just to enable sharper decision making.
Yeah.
Sure, how do we price the stadium and bums on seats was absolutely something that we thought would happen quickly, that we'd be able to help and influence. And there was a lot of that work already going on in North America that we thought we could learn a bit from. And naturally, we thought that, okay, well, when data becomes additive, in particular when web data starts getting combined with transactional data, what did you buy? Where were you on the internet? Who are you demographically? What are your consumption habits? We kind of thought, well, bums on seats and gate receipts will be the easiest to influence, and they'll be the first to learn it. And then it will probably be sponsorship, because London 2012 will happen and people will realize that sponsorship are business transactions. They're no longer just kind of pure media exchanges. And then probably we'll hopefully have a chance to influence participation, because that's important to us. And then broadcast seems pretty set, but at some point in the future, we'd like to think that kind of data integration and strategic thinking work and ultimate digital marketing would be able to influence the way people consume sport from a, we're still saying broadcast in those days, perspective. The premise of the additive value of data to drive different decision-making optimized by smart digital marketing, remains to this day. Absolutely, yeah. Bums on seats was where our business started, trying to understand where churn exists in season tickets, when fans aren't coming back, why they aren't coming back, and is that because of price? Is that because of things the club or the team aren't doing to enable a great experience? Is that because they're not able to sit with their friends? What are the drivers of some of those trends? And that was where our business started, working with Manchester City, with England's Cricket Board. And yet, what's been interesting is the way in which sport has evolved, and so our offer has evolved. And actually, the thing that I think is most apparent now is that you have those traditional breakdowns of revenue streams in clubs and teams in particular just are less relevant. So there used to be a sponsorship team and there used to be a broadcast team. relatively separate fiefdoms, both reporting into a chief executive or commercial director. That world's completely relevant now. Ultimately, what we're seeing is, if you're a club, a team, a federation, a league, whoever you are, it's really just about how do you monetize your content in a way that sets you up for the long term, sets your customers up for the long term, being able to engage with your sport. And in some instances, that might be running pre-roll and post-roll advertising on free content on your website. And you might do that in Indonesia, but in Malaysia, you might actually distribute your content to a pay TV provider who pays, a dollar a subscription.
Absolutely.
In some instances,
horses for courses.
You might have a direct-to-fan membership program, and it's all the same content.
Yeah.
And is that, it's pre-roll example is old world sponsorship. The other examples I've given are probably more traditionally broadcast, but they're decisions where agile commercial thinkers now are having to make those calls as to the best ways to reach the right audiences, provide the content they want, and ultimately return on that. And we're finding that we started a bums on seats business, thought we'd get to sponsorship quickly, but actually we're coming to sponsorship last, and it's broadcast content monetization and participation have got there a lot quicker than sponsorship has. And I would argue in the UK, it's taken a in the sports sponsorship market that I think we've seen over the last 3 to 4 years to create the learning platform to require the sponsorship industry to think a bit differently. because it's been the bastion of old world thinking for far too long.
Yeah, we talked a lot about that.
It's a long answer, sorry.
It helped a lot, and I'm struggling not to be really go deeply in the weeds in here because it's my day job, all of this. But you know, we talked a little bit in the Reform Club with the guys about sponsorship and how it was changing, and there is always a kind of like a flick of the tail that says, well, sponsorship isn't dead; it's just evolving.
I believe that for sure.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too. But sure. Yeah, but we both know that sponsors want different things now, as you say, it's completely linked to what you're sending out as content to a segmented fan base. You know, one of the things I always say, and I'd love your view on this, Matt, is when I try and explain whatever you want to call it, data-driven sports marketing or whatever way you want to describe where Two Circles is the market leader, which you are, I say something like this. I say, well, how many worldwide fans has Man United got? And whatever the number is, 600 million, something like that. And I say, well, if you take out the central TV deal from the Premiership, what's their ARPU per fan of that 600 million? And the number is really, really low. And, mm-hmm. and from my point of view, that shows the massive growth potential for what you're doing if rights holders change their mindset.
I think that's right. I did that. The other thing I'd say, though, is what's the average level of connection and engagement and fascination where those individuals who don't have a connection to the club have as well? And they're probably frustrated as well. So it's not just that the club isn't managing to monetize that broader fan base beyond the people in the core right fields. It's actually that broader fan base are pretty frustrated as well. They can't look into the club and get closer to them. That was the original premise behind the name Two Circles, which is, you know, the world that we've been looking to try and fix is you have one circle is the rights holder and the other one's the fan. And they're both looking at each other, just frustrated they don't know more about each other.
Fascinating.
And they're both looking at each other saying, we'd love this to be a Venn diagram, but right now we're two separate circles. And so I think it's a two-way street. Too often, I think... That the premise of the assumption in the industry is, well, data enables monetization, data enables you to make more of the fans you have and make a deeper commercial return. And that is true, but it's only true if the fans are and supporters or participants or viewers or call it what you want, it depending on circumstance, are provided with things of value that they actually want. And so, to that extent, it's definitely a two-way value exchange.
But would you not say, Matt, that the only way that clubs really know what fans want is to ask them, engage them, find out directly, and that. So I would still say that's in the responsibility of the rights holder. If there is this frustration,
I totally agree. That's in the data they hold, right? Data is a footprint ultimately. And it's just an enabler of action. Yeah, we don't sell data. We don't, data is the enabler to great commercial, marketing-led, customer-led action. It's no more than that. It's just the clues. You know, our job is to put the clues together, no more than you would in a game of Cluedo, to try and work out, okay, well, what's the next best action here to deliver for our fans, and in doing so, deliver for ourselves commercially, or put more girls on a tennis court, or work out how we scale Hockey World Cup this summer, you know, whatever it might be. And so in that instance, I think it's definitely a two-way street. Data is particularly when used in an additive basis, just provides the clues to enable that action and provides, for example, you know, you might not have first-party data, but you might have enough cookie data to reach out to millions of people in Asia to understand actually what would they want in terms of a deeper connectivity and connection to their club. Because only so many people in touch with a pre-season tour. But there are ways now in this brave new world when smartphone penetration in Asia is so significant, you can provide something of real value at relatively minimal to no marginal cost that where everyone wins. And ultimately, the future of sport, it has to be where everyone wins.
And I think that's the challenge. It's a very difficult balance. to come to the right solution where the segmentation of fans is becoming more and more diverse. But let's stay on Two Circles for a second, because I think hopefully that's given people an idea of what you've done in the sector. And I'd like to repeat, you know, you kind of like broke a lot of ground in this area. So about 3, 4, 5 years ago, I can't remember, you basically become the desired morsel for everybody that was looking to bulk up in this area. And you ended up selling to WPP, Sir Martin Sorrell. Tell us a little bit about why that was the case and what being part of that bigger group is doing for you now.
For sure. So so we set up our first day of trading, September the 1st, 2011. The WPP deal went through in April 2015. So almost kind of, it's our half-life, if you like, now if you think about it. And we've made good progress we're really proud of in terms of developing a good reputation in the UK. I'd hoped just for doing what we said to do. And the thing that had characterized our growth to that point and continues to characterize our growth is we're far more interested in delivering great work for existing clients than in new client acquisition. So our model, almost unlike high 90% of other sports agencies, is absolutely focused on quality and client retention. And we got to the point where, because the market was evolving in front of our eyes, we weren't really sure what the natural size of the UK market would be for us. But because the UK market was still relatively ahead, we had clients going to mainland Europe, we had clients going to Switzerland, and sort of saying, well, look, can you come too? Can you work this over here? And a client in Asia, same thing. And Gareth said Claire and I were really, really aware of wanting to do a few things. We wanted to invest a broader group of people in the company and the business. We wanted to, but we also knew that, you know, our mortgages were still on the line. We still had, I think we were paying, at the time of the deal, I think we were probably paying about 45, 50 mortgages ahead of our own. And whilst we're pretty confident that we were doing a good job in the UK market, we knew that to scale internationally and scale the business to the next stage, we needed it to be easier for us to go to new markets, set up businesses in those markets. It was kind of rationale number one, saying, look, we need a partner of some sort here to make that easier. Rationale number two was we also needed a kind of a next level of tech infrastructure. So we built ours up pretty organically and we're very proud of it. But, you know, to work with some of the biggest rights holders in the world, we knew that needed to improve and scale and pace as well. And that wasn't just a cash drain. That was a hard expertise need. And we also knew that we needed the backing of a much bigger organization in order that some of it in North America or Switzerland would take us seriously, beyond being a 45-50 person individual organization. So we put all those things together, and we were fortunate from kind of 6 months in, we'd had organizations approach us about, you know, would you like to, you know, buy a piece of you, would you like funding, whatever it might be. And we sort of had several of those approaches at the same time. International work's getting more lively, and we said, look, you know, we could probably hold out for another 18 months, 2 years in terms of the strength of our balance sheet without needing a partner in this, but it feels the right point for the quality of the work, feels the right point for the team, feels the right point because actually we're more intrinsically motivated by where this business can go than extrinsically motivated in releasing our mortgages. And so we did a quicker deal than the industry expected. In terms of those three things that we're looking for from the deal, it's absolutely paid off for us. Martin Sorrell was, I think I'm right in saying, the second non-IOC member to address the Congress after Ban Ki-moon. You know, it was on the board of Formula One at the time. You know, so it took us to a place. We were fortunate to have from him a disproportionate amount of time, given we were a rounding error for WPP's business even now. just because of a passion for sport, and so it's been an interesting ride, and they've been really good to us in terms of giving us the space and flex to remain entrepreneurial. I think we've paid that back in terms of the returns from their investment.
You certainly have. And I'm happy to say at this point that my co-host Grant Williams is with us.
A very sheepish and a very green-looking Grant Williams is here. Oh, I'm so sorry.
What's up, mate? What's up?
Oh, I don't know what I ate last night, but I've had the most awful night. And I was last awake at about 4:15, and having been up most of the night, I thought, oh, well, I might as well just stay up now. And obviously, guess what happened? Straight back to sleep. So I am so sorry, Matt.
No, no problem.
Don't worry, no problem.
If I disappear at any point during this, A, you know where I've gone, and B, you know I'll be back fairly quickly.
You're very welcome to. Probably need us to hold us to order.
Well, yeah, right.
Grant, we've gone through a whole lot of stuff here that
I can imagine.
Yeah, but it's good that you're back now, because, you know, let's take it back a little bit to sport. We've talked quite a lot about the business of two circles and data driven sports marketing, and, you know, taking that to the next level. Let's take it back to the field of sport. What the hell did you see on Sunday, mate? What was that?
No, yeah, look, I was at Augusta National this past weekend for the Masters, and I've been a couple of times before, and it's just a thrilling place to go, and it's a thrilling place to watch sport unfold. But this weekend was really quite something. I mean, we were very fortunate with the weather. The leaderboard was just packed with some of the best golfers in the world. There was excitement. There was close competition, you know, and at the end of it, you get a story like Tiger Woods winning it, which was remarkable. I mean, whatever you think of Tiger Woods, and I know many people are not fans, and many people actively dislike the guy, and I can understand. I understand all of it, but to see someone do that, who, you know, 18 months ago could barely walk, was to me inarguably something that really belongs up there with some of the greatest sporting achievements of our time. It really does. And we were fortunate enough to kind of be fairly close to him a couple of times, and you could see that he was so focused, he was so in the zone. It was impressive to watch, you have to say. And the crowd absolutely just adored him for it. It was amazing to see.
And where do you think that sits in the pantheon of great comebacks? I mean, I was thinking the other day, I was thinking of Muhammad Ali, obviously, you know, yep. Foreman. I was thinking of Niki Lauda after his crash, but I can't get anything beyond that. That's right up there.
Well, I think the thing about this, Rog, I think, is that it's not just a sporting comeback. You know what I mean? It's a personal comeback. It's a comeback from, you know, all the stuff in his private life that went on. I mean, he didn't just go from number one to number 100 or whatever in the world. He wasn't just injured, but he became this great pariah, this laughing stock. I mean, all of it, right? I mean, his life fell apart in every possible way. And to hear the way the crowd really, really wanted him to win. And look, he's had an interesting relationship with sporting crowds for a long time. You know, they appreciated the talent and they were kind of excited to see him do stuff, but there was never really any affection for him, I don't think.
No, I'm in that camp.
But you, yeah, exactly right. And even talking to guys at the course, you know, they you could tell, you know, so many people said, I was never really a Tiger guy, but I really want him to win this.
Yeah.
So it was a genuine affection.
Matt, what I wanted to ask you here, yeah, and dovetail this, because you do a lot of work with kids now, and also the English Institute of Sport, you're really involved in all of that. Will you be using this guy as a role model, or will you be saying something different? I'm really interested in your view about how you will take this example into the kids' world.
So I've thought about this a lot. And before you came on, Grant, I was just describing to Roger how the kind of Masters, I'm a Chelsea fan, but the Masters took over from Chelsea on the one screen in the kitchen through Sunday as the kids kind of wandered in and out. Maybe I've got to be a bit controversial on it, but I think there's quite a lot of recency bias in that take, that was the greatest, or is one of the greatest comebacks ever. For me, one of the greatest sp-
sporting books I've ever read, the most honest sporting books ever, is Open by Andre Agassi.
Agassi.
Not sure. I think if you look back at you know, the falling to 100 and whatever it was in the world, being prepared to go back to play, back all to tournaments, personal life falling away as well as performance life, and kind of having to rebuild a personality that's more likable, as well as a performance that's more impressive. I'm not sure I see in Woods anything that I haven't seen in Agassi.
That's a great point.
I have a slight, it's almost that grafting thing I was talking about earlier with Roger. There's one thing I'm itching for this year, it's for Pedro Kvitova to win a Grand Slam tennis tournament again after the knife attack that she suffered, because I mean, she still can't feel, doesn't have full feeling in her racket hand. So I have an enormous amount of time. Golf is a fabulous sport. I think it can teach some excellent stuff. I think the most interesting thing for me, and the thing that hooked my kids most, and my wife most, and me most on Sunday, I mean, I'm a awful golfer, so it wasn't any of the golfing performance. Actually, it was what happened directly after the 18th hole. And if you looked at the behaviour of my family in and around there watching the event, the bit that had them hooked was when he went out and picked up his son and then went and talked to his wife, because that's for me, that's a more interesting picture of redemption than anything that happened with Focus and 18 Holes might be. And I thought it was a really interesting tipping point, perhaps, for golf and the way that we think about sport, in that if you ask most of the population who watched that wall-to-wall, we weren't lucky enough to be there, Grant, I think they'd say that's the moment they remember. It wasn't the fairly stilted four guys sat up in green jackets, handing each other jackets in the clubhouse afterwards.
Yeah.
For me, for the first time, the actual award of the prize felt an enormous anachronism compared to what had happened beforehand and the storytelling through that. So I don't want to be harsh on Tiger specifically, but I do think there's a bit of recency bias in what we make of the comeback. And you asked me, Roger, you know, what will I be talking to my kids about? For me, it's the doing the most with your talent that you possibly can that I'm interested in. So I talked to my son a bit about Paul Collingwood as an example of doing that from a cricket perspective. I believe that whatever happens now, Andy Murray's done that from a tennis perspective.
Absolutely.
If Pedro Kvitova does win a Grand Slam, that will be what I'm more interested in getting him focused on. I'm not at all hiding him from the fact that people can go off the rails and you have to make sure, you know, to keep your finger on the ground the whole time. But at the same time, I'm not sure Tiger for me will, you know, in 5 years' time, it will be one of the ones I'm talking about.
That's interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought of the Agassi parallel, because you're absolutely right. The story is almost identical, except perhaps, Agassi was a star in tennis when there were so many other big stars around. And that's probably why the Tiger story has got more press than Agassi, because Tiger was the most recognizable athlete in the world. Yeah, but I hadn't thought of that. It's funny, we were talking about the same thing with Ed and I when we were there, talking about parallels, and Agassi never came up, but you're spot on.
I think it's... Sorry, on you go, Matt.
No, go on.
No, thanks. I was, as I said, you know, I've never really, as you know, never really been a Tiger fan. And, you know, hearing Matt there, I was kind of like nodding silently here saying, yeah, that's right. But I did admire him in that back nine. I did admire that look. And, you know, at the end of the day, a sportsman that can really focus in any sport is got to be admired. And I did love the bit with his kid, and I thought that was the real redemption. I was saying to somebody on Twitter who was saying, you know, like, I enjoyed it, but my wife didn't, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, listen, you know, the prodigal son, if we're getting into Holy Week, the prodigal son is all about that kind of redemption. And, you know, I like Matt, really liked a bit at the end with the kids. And his partner. I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, no, it really was.
Redemption is one of the most powerful things to see in sport. If I were to think back to
five things that will remain with me forever in turn, on a sporting pitch, you know.
That's a great list. I want to hear them all.
Murray. Well, okay. Well, I've given you five. I should have given you two. This is what I can think of. Murray winning Wimbledon, having looked like a rabbit in the headlights the year before. My favourite one ever, probably, was Stuart Pearce scoring the penalty in the penalty shootout against Spain, having missed in the World Cup. In the Euros. And the relief and the pent-up energy and the scream that came out of him straight afterwards when he had 85,000 fans with him. That moment where, you know, you look down the eye of it and you haven't succeeded, when it actually happens for you, I think it's just immensely powerful. I will love it when, it's a Kevin Keegan moment, I will love it when Elise Christie does win an Olympic medal next time around the block. You know, so those moments where you can kind of, you might have some success and then you struggle and then you finally make it happen for yourself again, I think are some of the very most powerful. Frankly, maybe Southgate's been through that with the England team recently. You know, watching Southgate during the penalty shootouts this summer, he was going through it as much as much as any of the players, probably more so, having been stood in front of one at times.
For our younger listeners, Gareth Southgate actually did miss a penalty that was quite important, but it's probably forgotten now. So thanks for bringing that up, Matt. but listen, that takes us into the Olympics, and you've written a book about the Olympics, Matt. And I'm getting the sense that you love those kind of like stories of underdogs that really produce it on the day after 4 years of work, redemption. Tell us a little bit about that book and why you wrote it and what are the main themes that you want to bring out of it?
Yeah, so I wrote, I guess I talked earlier on about the formative experience of, that my parents had on sport, and I actually co-wrote the book with my dad in 2011. So it's part history book, part business book, and part sport book, and it looked at the way in which Britain's relationship with the Olympics had, in the parallels between 1908, 48, and 2012, in terms of both the Olympics supporting a British environment and economy that was struggling, but also Britain supporting an Olympic movement that perhaps needed reinvention. And remodeling for newer generations. And so we were lucky enough to speak to 30-odd Olympic athletes, both who competed in 48 and 2012, to see and were about to compete in 2012, just to get under the skin of what it's like to perform from an athlete perspective, but also talk to some of the people at LOCOG and the LDA and ODA who were delivering the games. We talked to the founders of Parkrun about the challenges of developing sustainable participation models in the economic climate in which we all lived then and continue to live now, just to really get an idea of how the Olympic movement has influenced Britain and how Britain in turn has influenced the Olympic movement. And so it's a funny old book in the sense of, you know, you could see it three or four different places in bookshops at the time, thought it was a book about sport. Certain bookshops thought it was a book about British history, and certain bookshops thought it was basically a business narrative and an inside track into a British business venture. And I guess it was all three. But with the help of some incredible people along the way, we were able to do something which only reinforced our belief in the potency of sport to pull Britain out of a bit of a pickle. Needed arguably now more in 2019 than it is in 2011, but also Britain's ability through the mean modelling of the games to hopefully set the IOC up for different economic delivery models and things into the future, which is certainly needed from their perspective as well. So it was a massive privilege to do it. I'd love to write another book at some point one day, but to do it with your dad, with significant help of your wife.
Fantastic.
And your mum, couldn't get a lot better.
Yeah. Matt, did you think that the London Olympics changed anything? Because the Olympics everybody always talked about prior to London was Sydney. Everybody said that 2000 mm-hmm. Olympics in Sydney was the greatest Olympiad they'd had, and it raised the bar and it made them rethink things and do things differently. You know, I wasn't fortunate enough to be in London to watch the 2012 games. I was in Singapore, so I was kind of watching them at all odd hours of the night. but it really felt to me as though it was a special games, and it felt as though it was gonna maybe reshape the way they think about putting these events on. Did you get that sense?
For sure, I think it has in a number of ways. I think the difficulty with spending whatever you believe, spending somewhere between £8 and £10 billion on an economy on a long-term infrastructure project, with long-term aspirations in terms of participation, health and things, is you can't look at that 2 years after or 4 years after and expect to see the return. But if I look at some of the things I already noticed, I noticed the impact it had on my own kids. I noticed the impact it had on harder-to-reach communities, at least considering the idea of having some sort of sporting resonance in their lives with engaging with it. And the viewership was significant in our country. But I also look at some of the ways in which the economics, the development in that area of underprivileged London stack up. It's not a popular view, so it doesn't get many column inches. But if you look at the way Stratford has been completely revitalised on the back of that spend, if you look at the fact that £9 billion worth of spend, £1.5 billion of that was taking up all the earth in the Olympic Park, cleaning it and putting it back down again because it was too polluted to build anything. Is that an Olympic spend or is that just a British infrastructure spend? Yeah, we've now got one of the top 10 busiest rail infrastructures in Western Europe now runs out of Stratford. You know, you have tech cities, the Loughborough campus, all sorts. So it's really hard, I think, on this point to look back and say, what was the participation impact? Did kids engage with sport? For sure, there wasn't a significant short-term bounce, but I'm not sure whether that was what it was about in terms of participation. And there's a longer-term cultural challenge. In terms of infrastructure, I think it succeeded in spades, notwithstanding the challenges around the Olympic Stadium. I still think it succeeded in spades because we now have a cogent, coherent bit of London to expand our country into.
Matt, I wanted to end this where we started with Chelsea, but stay on coaching. I saw Glenn Hoddle, who, by the way, looked in great health in the studio recently.
Excellent.
Actually, you like the David Speedies of the world. Hoddle was just God for me. Elegant, straight back, two-footed, beautiful passer, all the technique in the world. He was my kind of player. So I also liked him as a coach, which is when he was at your team. But then he's in this interview last week or a couple of weeks ago, and he's saying, you know, I wouldn't let kids do anything apart from dribble until they're 8 years old. Never mind the passing, never mind the tactics, never mind. And I'd love your view on that, especially because you're so involved in early stage coaching and the institute and everything like that. Are we getting it wrong? Should we just let them get on with it?
Yes. So I guess to start with, I'm always fascinated, whether we're on this podcast or in other places, where people reminisce about what it was like for us to play football in the good old days. For me, football in the good old days was playing in infrastructure where there were barely showers, was playing on adult-sized pitches where the goals were enormous and the poor keeper was less than half the size of the posts, was playing with boots that got so heavy when it rained you could barely move, was, you know, even more worryingly, playing at the back, headering a lot of footballs that the rain had soaked up in and were used to have headaches for days. So I look back on, you know, yes, the camaraderie was excellent. Yes, there was less chat to the refs, some of those things. But it wasn't it wasn't the greatest football participation experience either. And I look at football specifically now, and I look at the quality of FA coaching provision into my son's team and the courses that the coaches can go on. I look at the fact that parents have to stand back out of the way and not get in the way of the referees. I look at
I refereed a whole under 12 season this year. Didn't have a single bit of lip from a parent. I look at the small sided games, the amount of touches the kids get the ball, the size of the balls, the lightness of the balls, and the type of football they're encouraged to play, whether they're 8-0 down or 8-0 up. I mean, to be honest, I think it's a massive improvement. And I think we're noticing that in terms of the quality of football some of our age group teams in particular in England are playing. So I think there's been significant improvements. Kids, for sure, could behave a little bit better, but that's down to me as the referee to manage it, I think. So I do think we've come on leaps and bounds. There's still, I think, at the more elite level of boys and girls football, still too much focus on success and points at an early stage. But my son's just finished an under-12 season that hasn't had a league. Right, so the league collect the results in order to see who plays who next week, but they don't publish the league. Connor has no idea where he finished in the league last year, and nor do I. And they don't really care, actually. They just love getting out on a Sunday and playing. So, for me, the FA are actually one of the best governing bodies we've got in this country at the moment. They're a really impressive top team. Participation team know what they're doing. You're seeing the strides they're making in the women's game. I hold out a lot of hope for football. I think some of the biggest challenges we've got in this country to create sustainability are actually more around some of the early specialisation individual sports. So the tennis, the gymnastics, the swimming and co as well, where we're actually, my understanding is we're looking for more specialism more early in kids. I just think that's dangerous because there's a great book coming out in a few months' time. I heard an interview with a guy called David Epstein who wrote Sport Gene. And his next book's about generalisation versus specialism in kids' participation. And actually, there's a lot of rot written about 10,000 hours and stuff like this. And you know, my goal with my kids is just to try and keep them playing as many things as possible for as long as possible. But for me, football's come on leaps and bounds. I know it might not be a popular opinion, but that's just some personal experience. That's what I've noticed.
No, Matt, I'm with you, but I have to say, it's funny, I was chatting with someone just a week or so ago, and we were remarking that you don't see kids just playing football anymore. You know, you don't drive past the village green and see a bunch of kids in ragtag clothes, shirts and skins just kicking a football around with makeshift goalposts and stuff. It just doesn't seem to exist. I may be completely wrong, but as soon as we had that conversation, I suddenly realised, you know what? I can't remember the last time I saw that. And that was all you saw I hate to say when I were a lad, but when I were a lad.
I do agree. And I think what you notice in provision for kids now is that it's far more structured. Most of the kids I know are being frog marched to after school clubs or this training or this activity or that activity. And there is less passive time for play, for sure, where the kids elect what it is they want to do. I think as a parent, I notice the concern I have to have now about my kids being alone in parks as it goes dark. That maybe certainly my parents didn't need to have 35 years ago, just because of the broader dangers in our society, for one. And I also notice the more active pursuits that kids have to engage with, whether it's Xboxes or PlayStation and things at home, that mean that going and kick a ball around in the dark when you're going to get muddy or you might have already played that day, it is a bolder choice than it would have been when it was basically Sabutio watching news rounds or going to play football, which were my choices age 15 or 12 or whatever. So, but that for me is exactly why sport can't, football can't, no sport can simply expect to kind of hark back to a day when kids have finite choices, and two out of three of those in my world were football. They've got to proactively engage in a more competitive attention market for kids' time. And the FA's app that came out a couple of weeks ago, Super Kicks, which is just a skill-based gamification app for kids to play with and lark around in the garden. Now, that actually has got my daughter out in the garden trying to win points and kind of progress on the app as a result of something the FA have put out there. And I think that has to be the future. We can't sit there and go, 25 years ago, we were able to go out and play jumpers to goalposts because our parents let us go and there was nothing else to do. it's just not the world anymore. So we have to engage, sadly, with a world of Fortnite, Xbox, 29,000 TV channels, and sport has to react to that.
Matt, I think that's a fantastic place to end. It was going to be my last question, but you've covered it. You know, some people say that, we do have to adapt to where the kids spend their time, to the formats they like, to their short attention spans. So we need to change our sport. But the criticism is that we are kind of like pandering to their bedroom digital, you know, goggle eyes type, and we're not doing enough to get them out in the garden. So I think you've covered that well. And I'd just like to thank you so much for this interview, because I've found it fascinating. You know, I've got to know you a little bit better in terms of the kind of player you were and what you like and the kind of guy that you like in your team and how you've taken that into your company. For me, it's been absolutely fantastic. So thank you very much, Matt.
And on top of that, I will add my apologies for my late arrival and possibly my early departure. But I'm going to be listening to the first part of the interview just like any of the other listeners, and I can't wait to hear it, I've got to be honest.
No problem at all. Look, guys, thanks for doing it, because from our perspective, launching a business that tries to challenge the way things have traditionally been done, you know, it's particularly the sports industry is really binary. You know, either you're part of the sponsored activation creative passion school, or you're the data guys looking to disrupt and take the soul out of things. And you know, it's just as facile as saying football is dead or football is thriving or anything else. You know, the sports media and sports industry media is very black and white. And the reality is that, you know, we're a right and a left brain business. I'm a right and a left brain bloke. I'm half introvert, half extrovert. And it's a lot more nuanced than that. And yours is one of the few podcasts that actually understands there's nuance to this and two sides to an argument. So thank you for taking the time to do it, because I know it's both a labour of love and quite a lot of time. So big thanks from us too.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you, Matt. That means a lot.
Truth is, like, you're very friendly about my football. Reality is, mate, if I had Pat Nevin's feet, I wouldn't be doing what I did now.
I'd be doing none of us would.
The guys are genius, but I'm no win. Wasn't quick or skillful.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Matt.
I mean it, guys. Thanks. You're doing a cracking job. Take care.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it. I mean, as I said there, I'm looking forward to hearing this as much as hopefully the listeners will be. And the first half is going to be as new to me as it is to them, for which, again, Roger, I apologise. But
the runs in Bangladesh, as they say. Any runs in Bangladesh?
I thoroughly enjoyed the part I participated in, and I'm looking forward to enjoying the part that you and Matt conducted. But what a fascinating guy, and what an interesting business.
It is. He's a lovely guy, really down to earth, and you know, he's fully involved in sport, both as a father, and you can see on Twitter he's always with his kids, teaching them, coaching them all the time. But he's taking that into an institutional level at the English Institute of Sport, and he talked a lot about the FA. I think, you know, somebody like that having a hand on the tiller for the British sports industry is actually quite comforting. And I can't tell you how gratifying it is that he likes what we're trying to do in the podcast. Really good.
That was lovely to hear. It's great to see people who get what we're trying to do here, because I think it's important.
Yeah. Absolutely. Good.
All right, mate. Well, look.
Back to bed.
The end of another... That's exactly where I'm headed. That's the end of another podcast. So all that remains is to thank everybody for listening, including me this week, and to just remind you, please rate and review the podcast, share it with your friends, get as many people into this as we possibly can. And if you do want to follow us, you can do so on Twitter at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. And you can follow me, should you wish to do so, at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always, it's been a shortened pleasure, but a pleasure nonetheless. And I'll chat to you soon.
And I'm really, really grateful that you got out of the bed to. No, seriously, it was great. and enjoyed the bit when you came. Thanks, mate. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.